Senator Stedman, Dyson, Hoffman, and myself, Senator Green, here for the next hearing of Senate Finance. And again, today we'll be taking up Senate Bill 141. And we're also joined again today by Senator Gary Stevens. And one of the things we're going to hear about today is a topic we've heard referred to and probably needs some explanation for many of us who haven't gotten a full explanation on this. Emil Schlotnick is going to, from the Department of Law, is going to explain to us the Gallant case, and which had to do with the Alaska resident COLA and what the impact has been and if that should be addressed. And then we can consider if we should address it differently in the legislation for the future plan. Okay, Neil, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Green.
Your name. And
right. I'm Neil Schlotnick. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And thank you for asking me here today to discuss the Gallant case. That's something that this committee, I think, needs to be aware of. It certainly is relevant to SB 141, and then I'm going to discuss a little bit into the future and get a little bit beyond the issues of SB 141 and discuss how this case will may need some legislative attention in the future. The Gallant case is a class action lawsuit in which the class is made up of all current members of PERS and TERS, and it challenges the constitutionality of the residents' cost of living adjustment, which is a feature of the both retirement systems that adds 10% to the retirement income of anyone who is physically present in the state of Alaska, any resident of Alaska who's physically present here. So a retiree who moves outside, or a retiree who is absent from the state for more than 90 days, or a disability recipient, does not receive this 10% benefit. And the class challenged this as unconstitutional under Alaska's Equal Protection Clause, saying that it burdens their right to travel, that they have a right to travel outside the state, that this is a burden. It's particularly a burden, they said, because there are now many areas outside the state of Alaska that are actually higher cost, or at least as high a cost, as the state of Alaska. So that those members who moved to those locations, they said, were penalized because their cost of living was just as high as the cost of living of someone who stayed up here. Now, one of the issues that we addressed first, before we even addressed constitutionality, is we discussed with the judge the question of what we called severability. And we made this argument. We said, well, let's not worry about whether it's unconstitutional or not, but assuming that it is unconstitutional, Your Honor, we think the right remedy would be that no one gets it, that the legislature would never have intended there to be an unconstitutional provision given to retirees, and therefore what we should do is just strike it completely if, in fact, it turns out to be unconstitutional. We made this argument in advance, knowing that if the judge agreed with us, that the class probably wouldn't want to go forward because there'd be no advantage to anyone. The judge did not agree with us. I've passed out, you should have in your packet, a copy of his order on this issue of severability. And on page 5, at the very bottom of the page, the very last sentence, partial sentence, what the court ruled was, plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment on the constitutional provision, which of course is the constitutional provision that says that you cannot diminish accrued rights of state employees in their pension. Plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment on Article 12, Section 7 grounds is styled as a request for a finding of constitutionally required severability. The court instead grants partial summary judgment on the related rationale that Article 12, Section 7 prohibits reduction of the 10% supplement as to class members while they are Alaska residents. So what the court held was that we cannot take away this COLA to Alaska residents under the Constitution because it is, in fact, a vested right in their pension. So that holding of the court, if it's upheld by the Alaska Supreme Court, certainly affects SB 141 and any attempt to do away with the COLA as to everybody. It is, the court has told us, a vested right for Alaska residents, cannot be diminished either legislatively or by a court, even if it were found to be unconstitutional. It can't be taken away. Even if the residency part of it was unconstitutional, there's still a supplement, there's still a benefit being provided. Any questions about this so far?
There's several, but probably wait till he's done with his presentation.
Go ahead. Say it again, Senator Shedman.
My understanding, Madam Chairman, is that there's been some interest in some folks that possibly live in Seattle or Phoenix, which happen to be a higher cost area relative to Alaska. And it seems kind of odd that the intent was to have a cost of living for living in Alaska, and now it's being twisted around and trying to be made applicable to golfing in Phoenix.
And through the chair, Senator Stedman, that will of course be our argument when we take this case to the Alaska Supreme Court and appeal Judge Suttick's ruling. In our view, this COLA doesn't penalize someone's right to travel. People still have the right to travel, but if you stay in Alaska, which is generally higher cost than the lower 48, then you get this supplement to your retirement income. But that is not the way Judge Suttick saw it. And he based his ruling on an old case, an older workers' compensation case, where there had been a provision that reduced workers' compensation payments. And it was based on a formula that computed the average wage in the location where the workers, injured worker was living. And it actually had the effect, the formula in effect at the time, had a huge effect for some workers who left this state, because average pay up here at that time during the pipeline was so much greater than the average pay down in the lower 48. And so the court found that that was, in fact, a burden on workers' right to travel, because in some cases, at least in the case at issue in that case, it cut their workers' compensation payments by more than half. So based on that ruling, the judge looked at this and said, well, gosh, you're cutting someone's retirement income by 10%. They're actually moving to a higher cost place of cost of living locale. So that looks to him the same. We don't see it as the same. We see it because this isn't even diminishing someone's retirement income. This is paying someone an extra 10% because they do live in the state of Alaska, which is, in general, more expensive than the rest of the lower 48.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Senator. Just so I understand this, many people are retired and do live in the state and do receive that 10% COLA. If they do go out of state for 90 days, if they are out of state for 90 days or longer, do they lose that entire 10% for the whole year or just for the portion of time they're out of state?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no, they lose the COLA only for the time that they are out of state for more than 90 days. They can reinstate that COLA as soon as they return to the state. Now I want to fast forward a little bit. This order came out back in August of 2003, and I want to fast forward to the current day and tell you where we are on the litigation. There was a question that came up was, well, if the cost of living adjustment being limited to Alaska residents is an unconstitutional residency requirement, what's the remedy? He told us clearly right here, the remedy isn't going to be that you can do away with it for all Alaskans. So the next question was, first, is it unconstitutional? As I've told you already, he found yes, it was. And then the question of the remedy. Does that mean that we have to provide 10% more to everybody so that it's not really a cost of living adjustment at all? And the judge said, no. What you need to do is to find out where the retirees live, compute the cost of living for them where they live, and if it is in fact as high or higher than their cost of living here in this state, then you will need to pay them the cost of living adjustment. And based on statistics that we argued, well, geez, that should be done by a state-by-state basis. At least we should be able to take a statewide average. So if they move to the state of Washington, what's the average cost of living for that state? And he said, no, we can't do it that way. You're going to have to go by the Metropolitan Service Area, the MSA, that the person lives in, and determine the cost of living there and see if it's higher than the cost of living in the state of Alaska. And he said, if you don't do that, then everybody, all retirees, regardless of where they live, will be given this 10% cost of living adjustment. And he said, I will give you one legislative session plus 6 months for regulations to come up with a new formula so that we have a cost of living, a constitutional cost of living adjustment. And if that doesn't happen, then everybody gets it. So, of course, the way he actually worded it is, I'll give you one legislative session after the Supreme Court has ruled on this issue, so that if it's affirmed, if my ruling is affirmed, then you have one legislative session plus 6 months. So that may be coming down the road. You may hear more about this. You will hear more about this, I think, next session or possibly the session after that, depending on when we hear from the Supreme Court. But that is something to keep in mind. There is another possible unfunded liability out there awaiting you. The size, we do not know. We had at one point computed the size of the unfunded liability at around 33 million a year, if I remember correctly from reading the some of the past briefings in this case. But that was based on some on the worst case scenario. Not just the issue of payments going forward, but, and this was the good news that I had neglected to mention to you, the good news was that they had also sued for past damages. They said that it was a violation of the promise that you've made to everyone to deprive them of this COLA, and we want damages going back at least 6 years to make everyone whole for this unconstitutional act. And we said, but you don't get payment for unconstitutional statutes. They said, well, it's a breach of contract. And we said, no. There was no contract to pay retirees who don't live in the state 10%. There was no offer and acceptance. The offer that was always made was 10% more if you lived in the state of Alaska. That was a contractual provision. And the judge agreed with us. He said, no contract damages. No looking backward damages. Only going forward will there have to be an increase in payment, and that's going to depend on whether you state come up with a formula for figuring out what MSAs have higher costs of living. So that figure that I gave you is an inaccurate figure. It was based on the very worst case scenario of damages, of including everybody in the system. And given that we don't know which MSAs are higher cost of living yet, we just haven't been able to compute what the unfunded liability would be if this ruling even holds up. But it is something this committee does need to be aware of.
Thank you. I do want to recognize that Senator Tom Wagner has joined us today. Welcome. And Senator Hoffman has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman. What percentage of retirees live in the state, and what percentage live out of the state at present?
Mary, do you have that?
Thank you. Sure. Madam Chair, the answer is 68 for PERS and 65 for TERS who live in the state.
68 PERS, 65 TERS inside. Okay. Would you repeat for us the people who brought this lawsuit, every group?
Well, it's a class action, and the class that they certified was a class of all members of both retirement systems on the theory that even if you live within this state, your right to travel, your interest in travel might be burdened because as soon as you leave, you will lose that 10%. So all of us who are current employees are members of the class as certified, because we would have this interest too, in a right to travel.
I mean, but there was somebody behind the organization.
Yes, and the name.
Who was the juice behind this.
Yeah, the named plaintiffs are a retired corrections officer who has moved to Hawaii, where it is, in fact, very high cost of living, and two, I think they were teachers who lived in Kenai who wanted to leave the state but hadn't yet at the time that this was filed.
Teachers, okay. Okay. But first, Senator Hoffman, did you ask your question?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Then Senator Stedman, Bundy, and then, no, then Wagner, then Bundy, okay? Stedman, please.
A lot of people probably have an Aunt Bee, but I actually have an Aunt Bee that lives in the trailer court in Mesa. So what you're telling me is I should pick up Aunt Bee and move her over to Scottsdale, which is a high-end neighborhood in the western United States, and she would get a 10% raise?
I guess so.
From the trailer court in Mesa to the...
Maybe higher.
Millionaire Lane? I think we got a problem with her.
Well, the thing that mainly goes through my mind, though, is how often do you have to do this calculation? Because COLAs change. I mean, they kind of go uppy-downy, and I want to know if you can't file, though, if you're in a lower area, why your retirement wouldn't be reduced. Senator Wagner.
That was the first thing I was going to state. They're living in an area that's lower than the cost of living in the state of Alaska. Let's reduce their retirement accordingly. But secondly, it is a COLA, and I got to qualify the fact that I happen to be on the 10% COLA, and that's one of the reasons I retired early, is it allowed me to stay in the state of Alaska. It also allows the income of those people to stay, and it's an economic impact, a positive impact in the state of Alaska. But I haven't heard you say what the solution is to this. Is a constitutional amendment, would that be a solution to, instead of say it's a COLA, just say anybody who stays in the state of Alaska receives a 10% adjustment as an incentive to retain their residency in the state of Alaska? In other words, puts our out.
Through the chair, Senator. Well, I would recommend that we wait and see what the Supreme Court has to say about this. We already do have a constitutional amendment that tells us that any residency preference granted by the legislature to residents of the state of Alaska shall be treated as fairly or the same under Alaska constitutional standards as under federal constitutional standards. And I can tell you, as I read the federal cases, this kind of COLA would not be viewed as a burden on anyone's right to travel. And so one of the arguments we made to the Superior Court was the legislature has already told, or the people of the state in adopting this constitutional amendment have already told us to treat this type of measure, a preference for Alaska residents, as leniently as possible under all constitutional standards. The court, interestingly, didn't agree with us that that amendment applied here, said this wasn't a preference as meant under that amendment, and therefore applied Alaska law. Now, you're talking about having yet another amendment to the Alaska Constitution saying, well, this time we mean it, and that will only work if, in fact, the decision is under Alaska law. If it's a federal equal protection standard that says this COLA were unconstitutional, that type of amendment wouldn't work. But I don't, that to me, so far at least, there's been no holding that the federal constitution would require this result. It's only under Alaska constitutional law, and I already think that this body plus the people have given us the weapons we need to defend it, and we will do our best to do that in the Supreme Court. But, you know, you just don't know.
Thank you. Answer your question.
Yeah.
Just follow up.
Yeah, just a brief question. Is there any connection, and if this were to be finalized, any connection with a similar situation in under the permanent fund dividend if you're absent that you don't receive that? Could people also claim that? Is there any connection, any possible connection with that either?
Senator Stevens, through the chair. Well, We argue that there's a connection deficit because that issue has already been decided under permanent fund dividend cases. The court has held that when you leave the state, you are not eligible for a permanent fund dividend, even if, in fact, you still are an Alaska resident. And that's the 180-day requirement that we have. The courts upheld that as not being violative of someone's right to travel, even though they're every bit as much an Alaska resident on the 181st first day that they're absent as on the 179th. Doesn't matter. You can draw some bright lines. It's a benefit. It's not a burden. We like that connection, yes. But if they were to decide that the Superior Court didn't see a connection. He didn't believe that he would be overturning the rule for the permanent fund dividend by ruling the way that he did in this case. And I don't, so.
Senator Bendy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wagner asked if there's an option and one of the options, obviously, if this suit prevailed, was to reduce everyone's retirement by 10% rather than increasing everyone's retirement by 10%. And when we do that, we also want to send out the names of the people that brought this suit to with checks.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think twice in the last 3 or 4 years, some group has decided to file a class action suit in a class that I ended up being a part of. In both those cases, we in the class were given a chance to opt out of the suit. And what are the rules about that? And should indeed we in this class be given a chance to opt out of that suit?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, there are such things as non-opt-out class actions, and to tell you the truth, I would have to go back and review the law on this and review the law on class actions. This case just recently came to me because of a promotion to the bench that happened in our department. The class had already been certified when it came to me, and I'm not certain to tell you right now if it's an opt-out class or not. It seems to me that when there's damages, you usually do have the ability to opt out, and there was a damage claim here. So I'd have to research that issue and get back to you.
All right. Thank you.
Good. Mm-hmm. If in the worst-case scenario, the judge's Superior Court judge's ruling is upheld by the Supreme Court, does that remove all possibility of repealing the COLA provision for all members of the existing retirement system, even if they are members, active members, not yet retired?
Madam Chair, yes. Yes, I would say that's correct. I think that repealing the existing COLA as it applies to people for whom it clearly applies under the law would always be a very difficult task given our Supreme Court precedents. Certainly under this Superior Court's ruling, that we could not do
that. And that would apply only in PERS Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3?
Yes. That's correct.
And for TERS, current employees. Tier 1 and 2.
Pardon?
And for the TERS system, Tiers 1 and 2.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator Stevens.
What was the question I was?
I said, if under the worst case scenario, the Supreme Court upheld the Superior Court decision, could we change the provision for active employees not yet retired and just do away with the COLA? I mean, could we pass a law that says there will be no COLA in the state of Alaska from this day forward? Or, I mean, I don't know how you'd do it, or if you just change the provision. And because this was clearly not what was intended by anyone. It was, as someone said, it was the incentive to stay here and to be, you know, equal to your retirement in another place. But So it's been kind of subverted or perverted in the process, and certainly has financial implications that are of concern to this committee. And certainly want to follow the lead of those in law and who have the legal responsibility to follow this, that if there are provisions or any work we should do in this committee, or certainly in our judiciary committee, that we be, you know, advised sooner rather than later.
Yes. Well, Senator Bean, I need to make clear that the Constitution has a provision that says you cannot diminish or impair the accrued rights of members of the state retirement systems. And the courts take a very liberal interpretation of that provision. I think it would be very difficult to defend repealing the COLA for existing employees, regardless of whether they've retired already or not, because once they have accepted employment with the state or with the members, the member employers, then part of their contractual rights includes that COLA upon retirement should they choose to stay in the state.
That's the that's a bigger issue if they choose to stay within the state, Senator Bundy.
Well, obviously my somewhat tongue-in-cheek answer of cutting everyone 10% is not an option then.
Any other questions? Anything else you want to bring to us, Neil?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Do we have an idea of what the extent of this unfunded liability might be?
Well, he said worst case would be, what, 30-some-odd million a year?
But that would include back damages, which is still a possibility, of course. The Supreme Court could reverse our win on the issue of back damages. There's always that risk when we go up. I mean, we're hoping to get the judge's decision reversed, but I'm sure the other side is equally hopeful to get the judge's decision on back damages reversed, in which case we'd have an unfunded liability of $33 million per year. What it would be under the judge's actual ruling is very difficult to compute until we've done a lot more research on the cost of living of the MSAs, where people are living, who would be eligible for what.
That's, I think that's the process would be so costly.
In the process,
you know,
too,
of all
yes.
The studies, the gathering the information of 100-some-odd, 500 cities in different places that you're, and if someone moves, then are they subject to another cost of living study for that MSA? I think that is just an unreasonable burden.
Well,
I don't know how you say that, but
if I could respond to that, Madam Chair, I did make that argument in court, and the judge just shook his head and said,
like
no,
it's
not going to be the sky is falling, Mr. Slotnick, he said. What you can do, we can identify 25 to 35 high-cost MSAs. Those are the ones that you need to survey. Everywhere else, he said, it's constitutionally permissible for you to make an assumption that it's lower cost than Alaska until proven otherwise. So that would be the burden. Even that burden, though, is not insignificant. And as you say, the burden of tracking
absolutely
is, yes.
It's ever-changing. Your target is ever-changing. Any other questions for Neil? Well, we're certainly glad you brought us some good news here today, Neil. I want to invite you back anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ron Zobel is still with us.
I know. There you go.
What did
he
mean?
He died.
Spirit.
Okay, Senator Stedman, I believe you're on with the contribution rates of the next booklet, the next chapter, one updated as of April 1st, 2005.
Madam Chair, what we'll look at today is we've got a brief presentation. We're going to talk about contribution rates on the defined contribution plan, and there's 7 pages of kind of slides, and then there's a packet here that has some examples of salary levels, ages, and so we can get kind of a feel for contribution amounts and discuss that item. But on page...
Senator Shipman, do you need anyone at the table to assist you? Either your staff, my staff, or anyone from the department?
Maybe I will go down to that end and have staff member Miles Baker here sit with me.
Very good. Okay. That'd be good. And then that way we're ready for...
As we go through this process, it's extremely time-consuming, unfortunately for my staff, he has no other support in the office other than me.
He has no life.
So there's been a lot of hours put in. Yesterday he showed up at 4 in the morning and got out at about 8 o'clock last night, and then came in this morning and worked on this. So, anyway, with that, I'm very grateful. Anyway, we're going to talk about the defined contribution plan, and on page, or defined contributions. On page 3, well, there's a little bit of a repeat here, and what we're doing on this is just a side-by-side to remind members in the audience kind of the difference between the defined benefit plan and the defined contribution plan, where the defined benefit, which is what we have, has the benefit level that is fixed, and as referenced earlier by the previous presenter, there are some legal obligations in modifying any of that. Benefit is based on a formula involving salary and years of service. The benefit is paid for life and to qualified survivors. And the future benefit payments are not driven by investment performance. And I'd like to underscore that. They are not driven by investment performance. And an example of that is presenters, all the tiers in both those groups. Under the defined contribution plan, which is the plan for the new tier in review, the contribution level is fixed, but it can be modified up or down in the future, if need be. The benefit is based on the amount of money invested and earned in the employee account. So rather than a pooled investment, each employee has their own individual account. The benefit is paid until the account runs out or until such time as there's a separation of service and the employee decides to transfer the funds to his new employer, or until such time of death and it would go to the spouse or the heirs.
And so that would be where the portability aspect comes in.
Correct.
And that would be the distinction between this and the previous plan we mentioned,
kind of
the DB plan.
Okay. An employee could work 5 years, 4 years, 10 years, and in the modern day, it's a lot more common to find people that have 3 or 4 careers throughout their life. And the idea is to make retirement plans portable so they can go with them, so the individual that decides that they want to have multiple careers aren't penalized at the end when they try to return. The future benefit payments are driven by the investment performance. Examples of this is SBS, the defined contribution plan, and in some respects a deferred compensation plan, which is an optional plan that we haven't really touched on. It's another mechanism to save money, and it fits in this example more so than the defined benefit. Then we have on the next page, on page 4, we have a side-by-side kind of showing the flow of dollars on the defined benefit, how the pension is paid out based on a set formula. The member contributes, the employer contributes, goes into a pooled investment or the trust and sits there and grows, preferably over time, and then it pays out a stream of benefits until the benefits are no longer needed. And I think earlier in the testimony, they call that statistically insignificant, which means there's been a demise in the member. The cumulative benefit payout over a member's retired lifetime is not necessarily representative of what they deposited during the active career. It really makes, in a classic example, which has been brought up several times, classic example is somebody that works in the system for 5 years or 10 years and gets retirement, or excuse me, gets health care for life at age 60. Well, there's no way that individual person could be contribute enough money to pay for that liability. So the liability side of it, or the obligation to meet the payments, whatever they may be, is borne by the employer. Over on the defined contribution side, the active member contributes and the employer contributes into an individual account. And then whatever that account happens to grow to, performance-wise, then the member can, when he retires, withdraw that in lump sums over their lifetime and their spouse's lifetime or numerous other alternatives.
Senator Bundy has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stedman, in light of the conversation we had earlier with Mr. Slotnick and the constitutional prohibitions, now, fortunately for all of us, lifespan expectation keeps going up. You know, the average Alaskan is living longer than they did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But the constitutional prohibition of making any changes in the defined benefit program, does that prohibition also include making any adjustments? So we say, okay, the life expectancy has gone up. The people who are currently in the plan and are beneficiaries of that expectation now must contribute more.
Under that scenario, Senator Bundy, when a new actuarial assumption table is imposed due to people living longer, that increased cost is borne by the employer solely. There's no way that I know of in our current structure to go back and try to collect additional contributions or monies from the employee, both working or retired, to help offset that. That is just a risk or a liability borne solely by the employer. And it's very, very difficult in 1960 or 1970 or 1980 to forecast out what the longevity and health care cost system is going to be in 2004.
And it might continue. And I expected that answer. I think the constitutional prohibition is very clear that even though I benefit by living longer, if I were a current employee, I guess I am a current employee, I can't be asked to pay, even though I'm the beneficiary, I can't be asked to help to increase my contribution. And while it's difficult to forecast out, to your knowledge, do the boards kind of hedge their bet a little bit, saying, hey, the last 50 years, or 100 years, the actuary or lifespan forecast has not gone down, it's always gone up. So does the board or should the board hedge some and say, well, the actuarial lifespan is this now, but you're just entering the program, so we expect that it'll be longer when you get to the end of the program, and so you ought to be paying more, even though it's not based on current figures.
Well, if you solely look on the actuarial reports given when they adopted the new actuarial table several years ago, there was a jump in the liabilities in kind of that adoption. So I would I guess I would question how much they actually do that. I think I would hope that they do somewhat of that, because, you know, every 10 years or so, whenever they reset the actuarial tables, they're always longer, and it's certainly no secret. So that would be a good question for the actuary, how they build in from the adoption of the table the slow migration to whatever the table may be in the future. But listening to the testimony from Dr.
Soli?
Yeah, Dr. Soli, and his concerns that the assumptions being used on the growth of healthcare costs may be low, and if that isn't, you know, so there, I guess the board is working on that issue, but if that is the case, and they have the rates, you know, through further analysis, and then he was talking about breaking it into a couple other components and doing some more detailed work. But if that assumption or question is proved to be viable, where the growth rates were low, then what that's going to do is push up the liabilities.
If I'm making, but you're not aware of any legal prohibition that would keep the boards or the actuaries from, again, like I say, hedging that this is what the actual limit is, projection now, but we're going to calculate it as if it were 2 or 3 years longer.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, thank you.
So the the little diagram here on the defined contribution, you know, the money available for retirement, again, is just going to be the funds invested, both by the employer and employee, and then the rate of return earned by whatever allocation or investments they select, most likely from a given list, much like SBS is, and then pull their retirement earnings out in, you know, a multitude of ways. But there is a difference between a pooled investment account, which is what we have today, and then the individual account. The next page, page 5, is kind of a comparison of what we have done here. Well, previously, just the aid in simplicity and working with a lot of concepts and trying to get a lot of information across, we used blended rates on TERS and PERS. We used rates that combined the average of the tiers, tier 1 and 2, tier 2 for TERS, tier 1, 2, and 3 for PERS. But when we sat down and well, actually from the very beginning when we started working on this project in this particular area, we wanted to run a comparison with whatever we came up with against tier 2 for TERS and tier 3 for PERS. So what we have here is a table that shows at the top the medical normal cost rate for these particular tiers, 2 and 3, for PERS and TERS, and then the defined contribution plan. And you can see that the medical cost rate is fairly close, not very close, but fairly close between TERS and PERS, 7.9 and to 7.2. And the defined contribution plan is down at 3.7. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute, because I think there's some adjustments there for us to work with. The next line down is the defined contribution rate. That is the rate going into the retirement side, or the non-medical side. It's 12.4 for TERS, tier 2, 10.3 for PERS, tier 3. And we used a target rate of 11.5. And then we have the health reimbursement account. Of course, they don't exist under the current tier structure, and we have 1% on the defined contribution plan. That gave a gross normal cost of 20.4 for TERS Tier 2, 17.5 or 17.6 for Tiers 3, and 16.3 for the defined contribution plan. Then you have to subtract out what the employee pays, and that's in red. the member contributions. 8.6 for TERS, PERS is 6.8, and we targeted a defined contribution plan at 8. And that comes down to the normal cost of, or to the employer for TERS and PERS, these tiers, 12.7, 10.7, and then on the defined contribution plan, even though it's put on the same line, they don't really have a normal cost, but for simplicity and clarity today, we put it on the same line, 8.2. Because we need to be very clear, under the defined contribution plan, there is no past service cost for the pension side, or excuse me, the retirement side, because it's technically not a pension plan. Now, the factors that drive the contribution rate decision, and I think what we'd like to talk about today, is in investment return assumptions, what's a reasonable rate of return range, the cost-benefit balance for the employer, the total acceptable cost, both to the employee and the employer, with the ultimate goal of staying competitive within the Northwest region. We had to put some geographical boundaries on it, especially for looking for teachers in our school system. And so we use the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. I figure if we're competitive in those arenas, we're going to be able to draw employees.
Oh, Senator Bundy has a question.
Sure. Thank you. Assuming this was in place, there was a quantity of money to be invested for the employee, would you envision that it might be something like the Amerada Hess, where it would be a subset of the permanent fund managed and invested by their investment people, but with the accounting fence around the money, or would we have to set up an entirely different fund?
I would imagine it would be crafted more along the lines of SBS. I think which is a supplemental benefit system that the state has for the folks that aren't as familiar with the system as others. But I think that question you brought up about management of monies, I think it's been brought up several times in this discussion. I think at some time in the future, the Finance Committee should ask the question, should the permanent fund manage the pooled accounts, which are the current retirement system we have, and just ask the question and have them have a discussion on it. It's been asked before, why does revenue manage just that portfolio, and when we have a money management firm, the Alaska Permanent Fund? And that's a reasonable question, but you know, we don't have that answer today.
It seems as if intuitively there would be some cost savings in consolidation and volume buying, if you will. Thank you.
It's just the non-broken out, the blended. Just for
Page 7, we thought that, you know, we have used these blended rates, and again, like for TERS, a blended rate is Tier 1 and Tier 2. So, you know, it would be, we felt an inadequate comparison to use the blended rate, because what we're really trying, on a comparison of what the defined contribution plan is, because what we're trying to do is make the new plan comparative with Tier 3 on PERS and Tier 2 on TERS. But we put these blended rates in there just because we've used them so much that we thought somebody might ask. So we made a slide, and those rates are there, and then you could, use them as you see fit. But we could go back to page 5. Under the normal cost rate for the defined contribution plan, it's 3.75%. Now, that rate includes some pre-65 health care costs, and the rate was from, the actuary. Well, when we got into the defined contribution plan, the medical kicks in at age 65, so we need to pull that out of there, that cost out of there, pre-65 medical cost out of this. And roughly, for conversation purposes today, we should use, it's going to give us about 2% to work with, or 200 basis points. So when we go down here in a minute and we look at how much should we put in the defined contribution side as a percentage of payroll, we have roughly 2% to work with. In other words, we, without changing the contribution of the employer, potential contribution rate of the employer or employee, we could look at increasing from 11.5 up to possibly 13.5, or we can take part of that 2% down into the health retirement account.
Reimbursement.
Or excuse me, health reimbursement account. So, we've got some numbers or some flexibility here through the discussion process before we even have to look at changing the targeted rate structure, which is kind of nice. But if we could kind of switch gears a little bit to kind of the white packet of this one here, which is titled The Comparisons of Tiers 3 and TERS, Tier 2, Benefits versus Defined Contribution Investment Amount. We were diligently working on our comparisons, and Dr. Sully came by, and he was armed for bear, which was good. And he spent 3 hours down in the office with Miles Baker sitting next to me. And then he graciously lent us his modeling forecasting tool that he had built, because he was on the tier structure of the TERS and PERS boards, and allowed us to go ahead and use that, which I thought was pretty nice. Anyway, that's the where we drive this model, which was a little different than we were building, and it had some issues in it that we didn't have. So we thought what we'd do is we'd use his model. Or a version of it. We modified some of the titles a little bit for clarity. And the page 2 is kind of the definitions of the headings. So when you're back in your office and you're looking through this stuff, you can refer to it. And we have the ability, of course, with variable inputs to run all kinds of contribution amounts and ages and years of service and to the point where it's really bewildering. So what we thought we'd do is we brought a sample with us today. The senators are more than glad to give us additional information if they want a different age, different years of service, so on and so forth. Run on the top of, we'll just go through like page 3 a little bit. The top of page 3 is a PERS employee. Over on the left hand side will key off on the top left if it's PERS or TERS or police and fire, because police and fire again have a little bit different numbers, and they're included in when we talk about blending PERS, we're bringing in police and fire. So in this example, the fellow is hired at age 25, retirement at 55, and years of service was 10 years. So he only worked in the system for 10 years, and he was out. His life expectancy is 23.8 years beyond his retirement age of 55. His salary, $39,128, inflation at 3.5. Inflation was derived off of the Anchorage CPI, not off the national CPI. And then the other box is the high 5 years. Most of these are variables. The top, the ones with, I think high 5 is not a variable, correct? Yeah, it's a computed. But I think the rest of them in boxes are variables that can be changed. The life expectancy goes to an actuarial table and plucks it out. So those are the variables. And when we look through a few of these, we can run any scenario that anybody would like. The contribution level on the left would be the total contribution going into the retirement side. We started at 11.5, and then we incremented it up by 100 basis points the first one at 12.5. Then it went up 50 to 13, went up 100 to 14, and then 50 to 14.5. And it gives you kind of a range. And again, we've got our plug number that we started with was 11.5. But we've got a couple of percent to work with. And what we could create anything we want, put it that way. But we're trying to come up with a reasonable range. So if we take, let's go down to where it says 13% because it's in the middle. And we'll just work on the middle ones. And I'm not saying we should adopt 13%. I'm just saying it's in the middle of the paper. The total, the next column over, 13%, by the way, may be an unlucky number, so we may want to modify that if we want to be in there anyway. But the total return is the total return on the portfolio, whatever is selected over time. And that ranges from 4.5% to 8.75%. The real return is after we factor out inflation. By the way, the permanent fund and ASBIB use a 5% real return. The final salary number and then the present value of the final salary in 04 this year, moving it back in time. The account balance at termination. So this fellow worked, again, 10 years. And then the next one is the beginning annuity value. And where the big modeling difference was between what we're doing and what Dr. Solaya was doing is he was taking and creating an annuity to compare it to an annuity at the end when you retire to compare it to the current system. Because the current system, how it's set up, is when you start drawing your retirement money, it's incremented up with inflation. You can't really go out in the marketplace and buy an annuity that's inflation-proofed. You can buy an annuity, they give you a fixed payment until you die, or you and your spouse, or however you're going to create it, but it's not inflation-proofed, and that's one of the challenges with annuities is if you happen to have longevity in your family and you live, you know, past the actuarial life expectancy, you beat the insurance company at their game, but inflation is going to erode your purchasing power, and it's going to hurt you over the long run. So what he did is he created an annuity calculation that increases with inflation. Even though you can't buy the product, it increases and with inflation, because what we're trying to do here is compare apples to apples. We got to get something that we can compare to tiers 2 and PERS 3. So that's what this annuity issue is. And then the next column over, which is the first lighter one, it says annuity as a percent of final salary. And you can see that the final salary numbers, I mean, that percentage is low. And the reason it's extremely low as we go down the page, you know, as we go down and look at different examples, as this fella went to work at age 25, worked for the state for 10 years and separated from service. And then here's an existing PERS pension benefit. So you can compare that, and then in the last column over is the defined contribution versus the defined benefit. And in a nutshell, it's a percentage. When it equals 100 or it's over 100, then it's more beneficial for the defined contribution plan if everything else holds true in the model. And if it's less than 100%, then the current tier structure would be preferred, all else being equal. So if we go down the next page, the guy...
Question, maybe.
Yes.
Oh, sir, Dyson.
The, I think it's column 10, but the existing PERS pension benefit, would you rehearse for me again all that goes into that $6,625, and is that annual or monthly?
We hope it's annual.
That would be the, that's an annual. That number is the annual pension benefit.
I don't.
It's.
Okay. It's, but I don't know what that means. It doesn't mean the total the person gets in a whole year is $6,000.
For this person. Senator, just because his he only works for...
Miles, I think you're going to have to speak a little louder so they can catch your voice.
Okay. All right.
I shouldn't get him up too early. 4 o'clock's a little early to be in office.
More coffee.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, this is the annual pension.
Okay.
The difference is that he's guaranteed that amount until he's assumes room temperature. So... the reason it's so low is because he only had 10 years of service.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you.
And Miles, that would have been calculated by the formula. 10 years times 2% times high 3 and all that.
Right.
And then that would have been your calculation. Okay.
Right. At the bottom of the legend page, the first page of this,
goes over that.
Gives you that information of how those things are computed.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I'm a little confused, Miles. If we look at the 13%, and if I just took 8.25 just from history, from the other chart, I look at that and see that for, I have $95,312 to spend, and I'm going to spend that at $6,625 a year. So I have 14 and a half years before my account runs dry. Is that how you read that?
Orient me where you are, Senator.
13% return of 8.25. And I have an account balance at the time I separated of $95,000, $95,312.
Right.
And I'm going to spend that at $6,625 a year.
No.
And is that not...
It's not that side.
The 6625 is what you would currently get.
I'm sorry. Okay.
What you would get from the DC plan under that those assumptions is the 5780.
50, okay.
Which is 118%.
All right. My question then is about how long that lasts. So it's $95,312 divided by 5,780. So I have 16 years of pension that will come to me.
The 5,780 was estimated based on the life expectancy of 23.8 years.
Yes. So it isn't until someone passes on, it's until this account runs out or they die.
Correct. But the only way to do a comparison,
okay,
because the defined benefit program is until you die,
okay,
the only way to really do a comparison is to make the best estimate of when this person will die, which is the 23.8, okay, and then work backwards from your lump sum amount to figure out what the annual payment, given a reasonable interest going forward, would be.
Okay.
Right. For purposes of the formula, you use 23.8 years in both cases.
Well, that's pulled from the mortality table, so that's a dynamic number depending on the scenario you're running. So this person retires at 55, he's expected to live another 23.8. this, I only use the male mortality tables, not female.
Okay. And then on that same line, Madam Chairman, how do you get the percentage of 118.9, the DC versus DB? Which numbers are you comparing?
Now that I'm looking at that, I may have reversed those. The point of, at least on this one, the point is to compare the 5780 to the 6625.
The present value of 204 versus the pension.
Correct.
So that isn't 118. That's...
Right. I think I reversed that ratio on this one. Yeah. So...
So he never gets to 100% under this scenario. He'd have to go higher than the higher than a 8.75% return.
That's correct, Senator.
Some percent.
And hopefully, I didn't do that on all of these, but on this one, clearly, that needs to be reversed.
What does this term year mean? Termination year. I guess that's what that means. Because that looks like to me that that's what that 118% is related to, is a figure under that year. Those columns have been reversed?
Madam Chair, that's fixed.
Okay.
I guess you could get rid of that column, but that's the termination year. So the final salary for this individual at the year he terminated, and again, he was only in service for 10 years, was $59,825. At the value of the dollar in that year, and then you bring it back to today, that salary is equivalent to $22,060.
Go over a couple, three more columns, and it says beginning annuity. Under termination year, it looks to me like that figure, 8116, is 122% of 6600. That's all. We're wondering if those two columns had been reversed. Because it follows right along. The 6.345 is about 95%. If you go up, that's what compares to this percentage. And I just thought maybe those columns have been reversed. So.
Well, I'll have to go back and check, obviously. But I think what I did is that very last column should be taking a ratio of what on the legends column 8, which is the present value of the beginning annuity, a ratio of that to the existing proposed pension benefit.
Mm-hmm. That's the ratio you're looking at there.
Right.
Okay. Senator Dyson.
Thank you. I want to follow up on the question I understood Senator Wilkins was asking. The deferred contribution, when the person retires, they will start getting X number of dollars based upon the value of in their account at plus whatever gets added every year from rate of return, and their expected life expectancy. So they'll start getting their monthly payments, and I'm confused about what happens if they live longer than the prediction, and the account has been paid down to zero. The account has paid out the balance down to zero.
Senator, through the chair, under the DC concept, there is a finite amount of money in that account. So, and I think Dr. Soli talked about that as being one of the risks that the employee bears, is this: if you happen to get lucky and you live longer, then you prudently planned for or expected, you could potentially run out of money in your retirement account.
Sure.
Which is not, and that was why he was arguing for the floor, which is not an issue for someone that's in the defined benefit plan.
So, and I think, pardon me for having missed a bit here, but, and then I think we're expecting this guy to live to 78, the 23 and the 55. So if this guy gets to be 73, will his life expectancy be adjusted in the amount he gets monthly change?
Senator, through the chair, not under the DC, under the current plan, no. He would just continue to get a benefit, and his actually surviving spouse or dependents would also. Under the DC plan, once you terminate from the system and take your lump sum,
okay,
it's up to you to do with that what you need to do or with advice do. And if your life expectancy increases, there's no mechanism to give you more money because you're on your own at that point.
Well,
forgive me for asking that question. It's already been covered.
Yeah. No, I think it is good to go over again, though. But what you have to go back to is that there is no expectation that a person who works only 10 years at, you know, and the high five is 55, that you're going to have a lifetime pension plan out of that. And so I think that's what we need to come back to as well. So,
and Madam Chair, if I could correct something, this is correct. You are correct. The ratio is the ratio of the, it's a future value ratio, which is basically the same. So the ratio is the six, for example, at the top of this one, at the top of page 3, the ratio of 60.47 mm-hmm. is the ratio of 4,006 mm-hmm. against 66.25. So you see that if you, under this scenario, with an 11.5% contribution and an 8.25% market return, you will exceed the benefit you get into the current system by 5%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, thank you. Very good.
So
any other questions on this?
I'm not as panicked as I was.
No, let's just have an at ease for a minute.
Yes, sir. At ease. Gary?
Madam Chair, for clarity, I think what we'll do when we do other presentations or whatever, I think we'll reduce some of the numbers. The one column, which is titled Present Value 2004, mm-hmm. we'll just collapse that and make it disappear because it just confuses the issue.
Yeah, okay.
What you want to do is take the beginning annuity on the term value, which is on that first page, page 3, which is 4,006,
right,
against the 6,025, which is the existing PERS pension benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So the equation is correct, and the percentage is correct on the far right-hand side. And we apologize for the confusion. We've been just working a lot of hours.
Oh, I know.
And then when someone questions it, you start questioning your own work, it is correct.
Well, I think it's good for us to have gone through that discussion because it certainly shows why the defined benefit plan is quickly underfunded and will always be as long as this system's in place, where you can receive an infinite number of amount of return for a limited amount of investment during the service years. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Okay, can we skip page 4?
You bet.
Which is a fellow that works. Hires at 25. Oh, yeah. No, let's hit it.
Okay.
He works. He's 25 years old. He works 20 years. He retires at age 55.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just use.
How could he do that? Age 25 works.
We didn't work continuous service.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
Through the chair, if I just clarify on the right. We'll see on these sheets, if it says early retire, that means they chose to, because under these tier systems, you can, if you meet the retirement eligibility, you can retire early at 55 as opposed to 60, and which gives you
an early retire,
which gives you more of a conservative Tamparis, and and if you do retire early, there is a penalty, there's a reduction formula that's applied for slightly less of a pension, but and that whole concept, the whole retirement age concept also would kind of goes away under the DC plan.
Under the DC plan, right, okay.
The last time we looked at this, we looked at 13%, and we were worried about being unlucky.
Right.
So this time we're going to use 12.5.
Okay, 12.5, okay, all right.
Okay, 12.5, you can see on the far left-hand side, we might as well just cut right to the chase, that's where the estimated break-even is when where you go over 100%. So if the individual made 7% or more on his
investments,
and there was a 12.5% contribution, he's better off.
Okay.
That's kind of how you read these tables, and you can see as a percent goes up, if the contribution rate is 14, then all he has to do is make 6.5%. And just for let's switch to the next page, page 5. The guy loved his job, so he went to work at 25, worked for 30 years, and then he retired at 55. No early retirement for this guy.
No.
Well, I guess he's still 10 years out, 10 years early.
Well, if I could just clarify, the reason for that is because if under PERS currently, if you have 30 years of service, you can retire at any age. So in this instance, he's retiring at 55, which is exactly when he concludes his 30-year service and does not get the penalty.
Right.
He starts drawing immediately his full pension benefit.
Okay.
And if we look at, for instance, the 11.5% contribution rate, which is the first group, and you look over on the far right-hand side, he hits 100%, or basically it's dead even at an 8.75% rate of return. If his contribution rate goes to 13, then his return requirement drops to 8.25, and so on.
Yeah, okay.
So it just kind of shows the differences between the age, the life expectancy, and years of service.
I'm just going to add, Madam Chair, this is a good example of how the DB system favors the long-term employee. As you look at this, even with a 14.5% contribution rate and an 8.25 market return, which both of which are pretty optimistic, it would be hard to beat the current benefit that they're getting under this scenario.
And is that because of the calculation of the high five or the high three?
The calculation of the high five.
It's the
high five, and it's the fact that starting at 55, this person lives another almost 24 years and gets a full guaranteed payment of his pension. So
does the calculation for the high five go away in the DC plan?
So nothing's based on your salary except the amount that comes in at the time you're earning it as a percentage.
So you have a greater contribution. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so Dexton?
Yeah, let's go down to page 6. Here we have a 30-year-old that works for 20 years, which...
I have one question before we go to page 6. On page 5, the way this is presented, the individuals that are under the TERS 2 would basically, everything equal, would get a pay increase, a small percentage increase of 0.65%, and the people under PERS 3 would get a payroll deduction under the comparing the two current plans. Is that correct? Because of their membership contributions.
I think
he's referring.
Compared to the 8%. I'm looking at the red line.
Eric?
Page five.
Oh, you're on the, you're back on the present, okay, we're in the tables. What you're looking at is a contribution rate. You're saying the membership contribution rate, the employee?
The member's contribution rate.
Right.
The people under TERS would get a pay increase because their reduct, their contribution would go down by .65. And the people under PERS 3 would get a pay deduction comparing the two in going from their current plan to the DC plan.
Are you trying to retire, compare TERS to this page?
No, the TERS comparing to the DC plan and the PERS compared to the DC plan. I'm just, you know, I'm going back to the paycheck that we're all concerned about.
Are you also factoring in page five of,
yes,
of this,
page five.
No, of this chart?
No, of this chart.
Okay.
I think, let me answer,
this,
you know, yeah, because he's back on the original table.
Yeah, I know,
okay.
I know.
So what, let me answer it this way. I think, if the salaries were all equal and everything else was equal, you know, clearly the deferred, the DC plan person would be contributing in the middle. He'd be contributing more than the PERS 3 person and less than the TERS 2 person. That's correct.
Thank you.
Let's see.
Next one?
Okay, let me pick up where I was at here. I'm going to look at a 30-year service, 30 years old, 20-year service.
Six. It's an early retirement.
Okay.
Page 5 is a normal.
Which line? Which percentage?
Just excuse me, Madam Chair, I'm trying to. It doesn't, there's no normal retirement, it's 55, 65.
45 service, he gets ready
to retire. Okay, let's. I think we did
5 of 14.
Yeah, let's do. We did that. Let's go to page 6. Because there's a lot of similarities, and I'm just trying to point out quickly how you can, you know, go down the left hand, or excuse me, the right hand side, and draw a line, and then see where one crosses. But here we have a PERS individual, 30 years old, works for 20 years, and takes early retirement. And you can, you know, just go down the right hand column and draw the line right where you hit 100%, and you can see where it breaks. On a 12.5% contribution rate, fella needs to make a 7% return, or a 3.5% real return, which is substantially less than the 5% target that thereabouts that would be the target for the pooled investor. If we jump to TERS, a few pages down,
what page? Are we on 8?
Yeah, let's go to page 8. Here we have a TERS individual comparing to TERS Tier 2. He's 25 years old, works 15 years, does early retirement. And the base salary changes. The base salary, there's a notation up next to salary on the tops to tie into the salary schedule, and you can see on the for the 12.5% person contribution rate, I mean, the later return break even is roughly it's probably about 6.75%, and then if there was a 14% return, excuse me, 14% contribution rate, then his return requirement drops to 6. So they're all interrelated.
Okay.
We go to police and fire. Let's do it, you know, because we're just extremely redundant here. So let's just, we'll go to page 12. It's redundant as far as the presentation today, but we thought it would be nice to give several examples of each one, which would, I think, better prepare the individual senators to send us, you know, what they want to have run. Again, we'll run any combo that they so choose. But under police and fire, and their numbers are a little bit different than PERS, so that's why they have their own separate entity. But this individual is hired at the age of 25. He works for 20 years and retires at 50. Normal retirement's 45, and his retirement age is 50.
And that's again because the police and fire tomorrow's. So you can start drawing your full retirement at any age after 20 years of service.
Senator Jason.
Yeah, I don't mean to nitpick at all, but when you work this through, it looks to me that you didn't change the life expectancy when you changed age of retirement from 55 to 50 in a couple of your charts.
I can certainly check that, Senator. I think the life...
I see what you're saying. We'll change that somewhat.
The same is true on page 14. But maybe I don't understand your program, but respectfully.
Check that.
Well, doesn't that account for the...